stay beautiful and stay safe.
This is VOA News, coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. The day after another night of urban street violence in the United States, a lot of people are asking what comes next. Many fear the answer is more of the same. It began with the outrage over the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis early this week. The 46-year-old black man died after being pinned down by a white police officer who kept his knee on Floyd's neck, even though he was handcuffed on the ground. A video widely seen on social media appeared to clearly show that Floyd presented no threat and was begging for air. Officer Derek Chauvin was fired and now has been charged with murder. The three officers who seemingly did nothing to stop him and who have also been fired are being investigated. Public officials are sounding alarm over the course of events over the past four nights. Meanwhile, violence continued in Minneapolis, where an overnight curfew was ignored by thousands of demonstrators, and fires erupted across the city's south side. With firefighters reluctant to enter unsafe areas, flames burned for hours. There were some reports of gunfire directed at police, though the shots apparently went astray. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says he is fully mobilizing his state's National Guard, that to this point he's had too little manpower. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says there's been an influx of outsiders coming into the city, determined to cause trouble, and that, he said, is not acceptable. The mayor told a news conference what's happening now in Minneapolis is no longer about protesting, but rather about violence, and he said, quote, we need to make that stop. To that end, he promised the largest force in Minnesota history will be mobilized to help deal with the situation. The Pentagon has put military police units on standby for possible short-range, short-notice deployment to Minneapolis. The rare request came from President Donald Trump. There were massive and often destructive street demonstrations in dozens of cities into the early morning hours. In Atlanta, Georgia, there is a state of emergency, and the National Guard has been called in. Echoing Jacob Frey in Minneapolis, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottom says what's happening in her city is not protest. She said it is chaos. This is VOA News. The coronavirus pandemic continues its deadly march across the globe. The latest Johns Hopkins University numbers, just under 6 million COVID-19 cases and well over 365,000 deaths. The figures here in the U.S., 1.7 million infections and a fatality count approaching 103,000. India has reported another record-setting day, nearly 8,000 new virus cases and 265 deaths. An Air India flight en route to Moscow was recalled to New Delhi in midair after it was learned the pilot had tested positive for COVID-19. Set to further ease its lockdown, India has lost close to 5,000 lives to the pandemic, with 174,000 cases. China reported four new coronavirus cases today, all apparently brought in from outside the country. Germany has begun allowing company managers and their families to return to China aboard charter flights as multinational companies look to get their China-based operations up and running. South Korea says it's found 39 new COVID-19 cases traced to warehouse workers in Seoul. South Korea has kept its virus death toll to 269, widely seen as the result of quick action early in the pandemic with the key massive testing. New York City, once the epicenter of the pandemic, is getting set to reopen statewide on June 8th. That's rather the state of New York. Some areas of the state already are back in business in phase two of Governor Andrew Cuomo's blueprint. New York has lost nearly 30,000 lives to COVID-19. 67 deaths were reported today. In a 5-4 decision announced early this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court gave its support to California's pandemic rules that limit the size of religious services. The decision backs Governor Gavin Newsom, who says the rules are meant to stem the further spread of the virus. The court said that did not amount to unfair treatment for the San Diego church that brought the suit or other places of worship. A judge in the state of Utah has blocked a concert meant as a protest of coronavirus restrictions. County health officials had argued the event, expected to attract thousands, could worsen the pandemic. The decision came hours after Utah marked its largest single-day increase in coronavirus cases with 343. With no new infection spikes reported, Italy has given the go-ahead for the country's scheduled June 3rd reopening of interregional travel for Italians and other Europeans. President Trump says the U.S. is leaving the World Health Organization, arguing it is totally controlled by China. The move will deprive the WHO of its largest source of funding. Mr. Trump says the United States will redirect those dollars to other global public health needs, though he was not specific. No immediate reaction from the WHO. The labor situation in Europe is showing new signs of strain. There have been worker protests against planned layoffs by carmakers Nissan and Renault in Spain. More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We have already taken 56,772 persons. The Electoral Commission embarked on that exercise. The other persons who are on the voters' register are those people who are dead. Dead people don't vote, man.
Ghanaian police invite an opposition party leader over allegations of threatening Electoral Commission officials.
Members of supporters who are not convicted of any crime. These people, the support that the Safe Corridor offers should reach everyone equitably and equally. So these are some of the calls that we are making. It is not that we are asking that the program be defunded, but that the right thing should be done, and it should be done in accordance with international human rights standards.
Amnesty International calls on the Nigerian government to save children affected by the fight against terrorism.
It might differ in many ways, but we are saying that regardless of the political colors that we are wearing, all we are doing is to make Malawi safe, make Malawi prosperous a nation as it can be.
And Malawian Information Minister calls on political parties to stop the politics of insult as they campaign ahead of the presidential election rerun. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Criminal Investigations Department of the Ghanaian Police has launched an investigation after one of the opposition leaders allegedly issued a threatening statement against the Electoral Commission. The police have since invited Bernard Mona, chairman of the Opposition People's National Convention Party, or PNC, to appear before it to assist with the inquiry. This after Mona criticized plans by the Electoral Commission to compile a new voter list to be used for the December elections. Mona tells me that he will honor the invitation of the police. He also added that the police should be independent and devoid of political interference ahead of the polls.
I will honor their investigation. I have said that if the Electoral Commission proceeds on its agenda to exclude more than 10 million Ghanaians from the voters' register, it will bring confusion at the registration center. And if the confusion is brought at the registration center, officials of the Electoral Commission will not be safe. That statement is conditional. I said if the CID or anybody has problem with his English, it should be that their English teachers were not good enough. So if I make that statement and the CID, without doing their own investigation, also decide to invite me, I will honor their invitation and tell them that their invitation was a useless one.
Well, Bernard, let me ask you this question. The Ghanaian Constitution gives the Electoral Commission the only body to administer elections in Ghana, generally. If I may ask you, some say that your statement basically undermines Ghana's democratic credentials as a stable country in the West African region. How do you respond to that?
The Constitution of Ghana in Article 1 says that sovereignty resides in the people and in whose interest powers of the state must be exercised. That is Article 1 of the Constitution. Article 46 gives the Electoral Commission autonomy, but that autonomy is not without the power and sovereignty of the people of Ghana. And that in exercising any powers granted you, that power must be exercised in a manner that fulfills Article 1 of the 1992 Constitution, which is the Ghanaian Constitution. We have not violated any law. The Article 3 of our Constitution says that to the extent that there is any institution or individual that is engaged in any act that will lead to the disability of this nation, we should resist it. all we are doing is that the Electoral Commission, by its perfidy, is leading Ghana's democracy away from peace, and we must do everything to resist the Electoral Commission from leading our nation into calamity. That is what I am doing. I am not in breach of the Constitution, and I am fully aware of my rights as a citizen, and I will fight in defense of the nation's peace and stability.
But, Bernard, why are you saying the Electoral Commission plans on disenfranchising prospective Ghanaians who will perhaps vote in the upcoming December election, when in fact they have the mandate to compile a voter list to be used for the election?
No, we already have a compiled voter list. And if you check the laws of the election, it says that the Electoral Commission shall compile a voter's register. We have already compiled one, and that they can revise it. Revision of a voter's register is not a replacement of a voter's register. So as we speak, we have a compiled voter's register, which voter's register brought in President Akufo-Addo, which enables our 275 members of parliament to have legitimacy, which voter's register we used recently to create 6 new regions through a referendum, which voter's register we used again just on the 17th of December 2019 to elect 6,600 assemblymen and women, and also 33,000 persons into the unit committees of our various localities. So the voters register is a credible voters register that is without blemish. So anyone who wants to change a very credible voters register for something whose credibility we are yet to understand, that person must have something mentally wrong with you people.
Bernard, let me ask you, if you say you won't allow that, what recourse do you have? Because you're talking about resistance to a mandate that the Electoral Commission is exercising by proposing a date
to disenfranchise people. You don't have, the Electoral Commission doesn't have a mandate to disenfranchise people.
But they want to compile a voter register to allow people to vote.
We have already compiled a voter's register. You can revise it by adding on to it or subtracting.
But there have been instances where allegations of voter impropriety, where names that should not be in are in. They are talking about pictures that were in order.
The Supreme Court, that is why the Supreme Court asked that we should cleanse the voter's register, particularly of persons who registered and obtained their voter ID card with the National Health Insurance card. We cleanse the voter register where over 56,772 persons' names were deleted from the voter's register. So if you want to clean the voter's register, you can go ahead and clean it. Don't go and replace it, because we have already taken 56,772 persons. The Electoral Commission embarked on that exercise. The other persons who are on the voter's register are those people who are dead. Dead people don't vote, man.
Bernard Mona is the chairman of the Ghanaian Opposition People's National Convention Party, or PNC. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. In Nigeria, Amnesty International has called on the government to help children ravaged by the war against Islamic militant groups or risk losing generations in parts of the country's north. The conclusion was contained in the latest report released by the organization. Titled "We Dried Our Tears," the report calls on the government to expedite action to protect and provide education to an entire generation of children in the northeast. The region, it says, has been devastated by years of violence carried out by the Boko Haram militant group. To learn more about the latest report, I reach Sheung Bakari, Programs Manager for Amnesty International Nigeria.
The report, "We Dried Our Tears, Addressing the Toll on Children of Northeast Nigeria's Conflict," examines how the Nigerian military's widespread unlawful detention and torture have compounded the suffering of children from Borno and Adamawa State. And these children are children who faced war crimes and crimes against humanity at the hands of Boko Haram. On the whole, we looked at crimes committed by Boko Haram against children. We looked at crimes committed by the Nigerian military against children. And we looked at how the Safe Corridor program, which is supposed to be a demobilization and reintegration program, how it is deeply flawed and how it is achieving the exact opposite of what it is supposed to achieve. So this is the general overview of the report.
Let me ask you this, Sheung. What can the Nigerian government do to resolve some of these findings that the report clearly stipulates?
If you look at the report, you will find that we made a number of recommendations to not only the federal government, but also the state government. We understand as an organization that the power to redress the violations and abuses that are ongoing in the Northeast, these powers lie in the hands of the federal government. So we made a number of recommendations, which include asking the federal government to take seriously the duty to promote and protect the rights of children who are in detention. We also want the government to ensure accountability, ensure reparations, and non-repetition of violations from both sides. Violations from the Nigerian military against these children and abuses from Boko Haram against these children.
Sean, let me ask you this, because some Nigerians are saying that it appears Amnesty International always certainly accuse or criticize the Nigerian military, but yet do not condemn in any way, form or fashion, Boko Haram. Why is this so? And do you think the criticism is justified?
Let me say that every single time that we have brought out the report, one of the things that we ensure is credibility, but we also strive to achieve balance. We ensure that we report what we find on the field. And this report is not different. You see, the first substantive chapter in this report examines in detail Boko Haram's many crimes against children, including abduction, recruitment and use of children, forced marriage, rape, and other sexual violence. There are a range of crimes that Boko Haram continues to commit, which we have detailed in the first substantive chapter of that report. And then, of course, we discuss the violations that have been committed by the Nigerian military. So it is a false narrative to say that we do not condemn Boko Haram.
There are some people who are suggesting that perhaps Amnesty International should leave the plight of children, in this case in the Nigerian context, for UN humanitarian agencies and other agencies that take care of children, instead of dabbling in it. So they asked, why is Amnesty International so suddenly interested in the plight of the Nigerian child currently?
If you look at the report focuses on children and young people, definitely. But the conflict has been devastating for almost everyone in Northeast Nigeria. I mean, when we went on research, it was difficult to find any community or any individual who has not been impacted in some way by the decade of violence that has been ongoing in that place. So while we agree that there are other people who are doing this work, but once we got to the field, what we found was staggering. We are not a humanitarian organization. We seek to promote and defend human rights worldwide, including through the documentation of serious crimes and other human rights violations.
Before we go, Sheung, the report expressed concern about funding by international organizations to help this underprivileged or those children caught in the crossfire with this insurgency. Does that mean that Amnesty International wants the program defunded, or perhaps the funds they bring in should be channeled elsewhere? What does Amnesty International want this funding to be used for, if not what is being currently done?
Amnesty is not demanding that donors automatically defund Safe Corridor. No. Rather, what we are saying is that we are calling on those donors to recognize that Safe Corridor is a detention facility and to strongly consider conditioning further support on the Nigerian authorities, making changes to ensure that due process is respected, so that those who end up at Safe Corridor should have a lawful basis for being detained, while those who do not should be released. Amnesty actually believes that donors should support more comprehensive reparation and assistance efforts under the demobilization, disassociation, reintegration and reconciliation program and beyond, even including for victims of crimes by Boko Haram and by the military, as well as for people that are coming out of these Boko Haram controlled areas. They should not be detained, including former members or supporters who are not convicted of any crime. These people, the support that the Safe Corridor offers should reach everyone equitably and equally. So these are some of the calls that we are making. It is not that we are asking that the program be defunded, but that the right thing should be done, and it should be done in accordance with international human rights standards.
Sheung Bakare is the program's manager for Amnesty International Nigeria. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The founder of the Cameroonian opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF, has dismissed rumors of his demise. John Fru Ndi says he is currently in the United States, rejecting the news circulating on social media platforms and picked up by some local media outfits. Fru Ndi says this is not the first time he has been presumed dead. Local journalists say the rumors started when supporters of the party could not determine the whereabouts of the opposition leader. John Fru Ndi tells me that he plans to return home after the conclusion of his medical review by his doctors.
No, well, this is not the first time that sometimes some of the misguided people in Cameroon say about people. They said this about me before several times, and they said it about Mr. Paul Biya. They said it about other people, and I don't know what the problem with politicians is. They always wish you death, but thank God that I'm living and we are talking, so I am not dead.
When you received such information, what was your reaction?
Well, my reaction is that maybe there's something you are doing which is good and the evil people don't want you to be alive to do that.
So at the moment, where are you currently, if I may ask? And do you feel comfortable sharing with us where you are? Because I guess your presence or lack of presence where they expect you to be is the basis from which they are making such allegations or conjecture, if you may.
I am in Georgia, Atlanta, and I'm here because I've not been well. You know, when the Ambazonians abducted me in Cameroon, they rolled their guns, they hit my head several times with their gun, and this made my head to be spinning. So I came here to seek medical treatment. When I came here, unfortunately for me, the COVID-19 pandemic blocked me here. The airways are blocked. Unfortunately for me, again, the doctors here were all engaged with the COVID-19. So I've not really had the check. As soon as I have the checks and I feel better, I'll go.
Now, Mr. Fundi, what reports are you hearing back home about the fight against the coronavirus in your country, Cameroon?
I'm told that the viral thing is gaining grounds. And by yesterday, they told me that the number of people affected has hit 5,000, which is very unfortunate. And this hitting 5,000 with all the problems we have in Cameroon, you have people in refugee camps, you have Anglophones who've escaped in Douala, Yaoundé, Bafoussam, and the other places. And these things are hitting Douala, Yaoundé, and I'm told Bafoussam. And you know that it's a disease that is looking for the suffering people. And the Anglophones that are there, principally, are not under very good conditions. They're parching, they're sleeping under very poor conditions and healthy conditions, and I am afraid of their lives. I just pray and hope and wish that they take very good care of themselves by keeping to the international prescribed norms, to wash their hands well, to keep the distancing and wear masks.
Let me ask you this, Mr. Fru Ndi. A few days ago, an anniversary was chalked by your party that you established, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF. If I may ask you, do you think your objective by changing how things are done in Cameroon politically has been achieved? And were you able, or have you been able, to change the political dynamics, the reason why you established your party?
We've not changed the whole system yet, but we've done cosmetic changes. That at the time when we launched the party, Cameroonians themselves could not talk. You could not talk to a gendarme on the road. But today people have debates, quarrels, and even fights with gendarmes because the gendarme was a god. And the elections were always announced in Yaoundé. But today people go in for elections. Though the elections are scam, we've been able to push that people can go out campaign. They can vote, though elections are always rigged. We still believe that we're on the right path and we're pushing. And one day, it never comes straight overnight, but we have to keep pushing.
Before you go, Mr. Fru Ndi, what do you see as the prospect of your party in the future?
The party is on a good footing. We are able to participate in elections, though we are always cheated, and they bring people with guns to fight and intimidate voters, which is a literally that voted in this last election. So, but we still think that we are online fighting. You might not win the fight in the first round, but someday you'll be able to do it. But going to war Some people have chosen that option. But, and you know how many people have been killed in Gaborone through this option. We thought that by all coming out together to understand our plight and voting, that something could have been done through that way. But to go through the war option with what so many people dying, and people tell you that the international community that is overloaded with so many things happening all over the world, and presently is the COVID-19 thing that is preoccupying them, I don't think that they'll turn to look at Cameroon.
John Fruindi is the founder of the Cameroonian opposition party, the Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from Atlanta, Georgia, here in the United States. Malawian Information Minister has cautioned politicians to desist from insults and character assassinations in their respective campaigns before the upcoming presidential poll rerun. Mark Botomani says it is important for politicians to focus on addressing challenges the country faces and how they can resolve them instead of issuing insults. His remarks come after local media report of political leaders insulting each other during their campaigns. Malawian Information Minister Mark Botomani tells me that the two leading political parties need to focus on the issues to enable the citizens to choose the best qualified candidate to become the next president.
It's true, Peter, that I issued that statement on behalf of government. Basically, we are concerned about the pronouncements that have been characterizing the presidential campaign that we have now in Malawi, where you find that, you know, these political leaders spending more time, you know, mudsliding, name calling, and all what it takes to be a bad politician, than talking about issues that they need, people need to hear.
No, but Mark, the opposition is of the view, Opposition Alliance, MCP, UTM Alliance, are of the view that the attacks emanated or started from members of the ruling party hurling insults at them, and they just replied in, you know, in good measure. So they should not be blamed, they said, for these politics of insult started by the ruling party. How do you react to that?
That is neither here nor there. I don't think if you see someone stealing, and so you justify your stealing by saying, oh, because I found somebody that is stealing, I don't think that is a good yardstick. They themselves, in their own right, they have taken the campaign out there instead of dwelling on issues, but they have dwelled on character assassination, even mentioning names of people that are no longer practicing politics, like, for example, the former president, Bakiri Muluzi. So we felt that is not right. And for your information, Peter, that communication is not only going to the opposition, it's all across the board. We're saying anybody who is doing campaign this time around, let them dwell on issues. Because people out there want to know how their government is going to sort out issues of, you know, water, for example, clean and potable water, agriculture issues, you know, security, and all those kind of issues that need to be tackled in campaigns rather than dwelling on petty issues of character assassination and what have you.
Mark, how is your administration addressing the challenges of politically related violence in the run-up to the poll?
We have strengthened the security, especially in the hotspots, the places where, you know, these attacks or these political attacks started. There are some selected districts in the southern region and the central region, as well as some parts of northern region. Security has been enhanced. And other than that, we are doing a lot of civic education to the people through various stakeholders. They are doing advocacy work and civic education, as well as government is also using it's the ministry, my ministry actually, because we also do civic education. So essentially just to, you know, to remind people that campaign does not mean beating each other or slay each other. It's about issues. It's about letting playing field to be leveled for everyone to participate.
Has the president begun the process of selecting or choosing, as mandated by the Constitution, the new chairperson to lead the Malawi Electoral Commission, or perhaps constitute a new electoral commissioner that will lead in the organization or administering of this anticipated presidential election rerun?
Yes, currently the president has informed all political parties that are mandated to submit names or to nominate names of those that want to be commissioners in the Malawi Electoral Commission. So the president will be receiving those names and he will be appointing commissioners from those names. He has also informed the judiciary so that the judiciary can submit a name. Where the president will appoint, a chairperson. As you know, that the constitution says that the chairperson can only be a judge, in the judiciary.
So, what is the message here? The overarching message to the people of Malawi as campaigning intensifies in the run-up to the upcoming election.
This is a peaceful country, as you know, Peter. We have never seen tribal wars or ethnic wars in this country, or even, wars that have emanated from elections. We have had peaceful elections ever since we adopted, multi-party in 1994. Therefore, we will continue on that same path. Malawians know that this administration in particular strengthens the tenets of democracy and indeed coexistence and peacefulness. And so that's what that's the message that we're carrying to the people, to say we might differ in many ways. But we are saying that regardless of the political colors that we are wearing, all we are doing is to make Malawi safe, make Malawi prosperous a nation as it can be.
Mark Botomani is the Malawian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Zambian Information Minister Dora Selia says she is doing well despite testing positive to the coronavirus. The information minister recently revealed she tested positive to the disease. Unlike others, she says, she shows no signs of the disease. The announcement, the information minister says, was aimed at dispelling stigmatization of the coronavirus. She self-quarantined in order not to infect people she came into contact. Since her announcement, the health minister also announced his infection. Local media reports that some citizens disbelieve that the disease is in the southern African country. Due to that, the reports add some Zambians defy restrictions imposed by the government to limit the spread of the disease. Information Minister Dora Selia tells me that the administration in Lusaka continues to demonstrate commitment in the fight to halt the spread of the coronavirus.
Well, two reasons, basically. First of all, on a personal level, I have had to keep away from my family for quite a while because I'm one of those who've been very involved in risk communication as far as government strategy is concerned in terms of disseminating information about the coronavirus to the Zambian people. And by virtue of my position as the government spokesperson, I have had to be in contact with a lot of people. And even though I have taken all precautions, I felt that I needed to protect my family and I've been away from them for quite a while. And then I felt that if I was going to see my mother, especially who's in her 70s, I felt that it was important that I was sure, even though I was going to see her wearing a mask, that I was sure that I would not be exposing her and the rest of my family. But more importantly, as minister, I felt also a personal obligation that once I knew I was positive, that I needed to share this with the public to give confidence and sort of destigmatize this disease.
Now, Honorable Minister Selia, some people are suggesting that the stigmatization alone is enough for people not to go to the hospital to be checked out for this disease. Is there a policy direction from your administration to help destigmatize this disease to ensure that people who are infected are properly taken care of so they could possibly recover and not die like in other places where reports of high infection rates and deaths and among other challenging issues?
One of the things my president, President Edgar Lungu, has been very clear about from the very beginning, we are only in about 3 months of this disease in Zambia. But from 6 weeks ago, he really started telling the whole country that this is the new normal. We have to live with this disease. We should treat it as a new normal. And by that it is just a disease, and we must do a lot of community screening so that as many people as possible should understand that the facilities were there for testing, and that they could get the attention from the medical experts as much as they could. For those who have tested positive, government has provided facilities for them to be attended to. And for those who are symptomatic, like myself, are positive but are not yet showing the signs, that you can actually be monitored from your own home or your own space.
Honourable Minister Saleya, some are suggesting that the government should have announced restrictions in Lusaka particularly and across the borders, and particularly the international airport shutdown, to ensure that the administration contained and prevented the spread of the disease as a strong measure and a sensitization effort launched. What do you say to such critics who say the government was lackadaisical and appeared ill-prepared to combat the spread of the disease from its onset?
I think the government hasn't got the luxury of just making comments. His Excellency the President, once again, from the very first day, was very clear to with all of us that this is a health problem, but it's also a social economic problem. For Zambia, that is a landlocked country, that was even a bigger challenge because we didn't even have to lock down. We were locked out by all our neighbors, meaning that for us, we have to think about bringing tests in the country, bringing medication in the country, not just for trying to contain corona symptoms, but everyday diseases, malaria, children, pregnant women, TB, ARVs for HIV. So as a landlocked country, logistical nightmare was our biggest issue. We shut down all the other airports except one, and the airlines actually stopped flying into Zambia except one Ethiopian Airlines, which is flying once a week. And that is how we've been even getting the test kits in the country.
So, Minister Saleya, I understand your government has begun opening some sectors of the economy to encourage people to begin working. Others are saying the reopening on parts of the economy, including the tourism sectors, is a recipe for an expedited infection rate increase of the disease. How do you respond to such concerns being expressed by Zambians?
I think the majority of the Zambians are very happy with what the government has done, headed by the president. That I can assure you, a lot of Zambians are very happy because it is a Zambian who are suffering when a bar or a restaurant is closed. It is a Zambian that lost an income, and it is a Zambian that said, Mr. President, before the corona kills us, we'll actually die of hunger or be rioting on the streets, as we've seen in other jurisdictions. It is a Zambian that said, because of this partial lockdown, I can't get any business, I'm a taxi driver, and now how am I going to feed my family? It is a Zambian that said, because the gym is closed, I cannot get enough income, and as a result, how am I going to feed my family? It is the Zambians who said our children's education has been disrupted. How are we going to get this back, especially those who are in exam classes? And that's why the schools for exam classes only will be opening on the 1st of June. The choice is that we cannot just attend to health issues and ignore socioeconomic issues. What is correct is to find a balancing act. And that's what we've been doing.
Dora Saleya is the Zambian Information Minister. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Burundi, the main opposition CNL party has petitioned the Constitutional Court seeking to challenge the outcome of last week's general election. The party's presidential candidate, Agathon Rwasa, rejected the results of the election, saying it was fraught with irregularities and rigging. His rejection of the result is backed by civil society and religious groups. They allege the ruling party appears to have added ballots of dead people and to some in jail to increase its share of the total vote cast. The ruling party rejects the accusations of voter fraud. For analysis of the latest development, I reach Richard Moncrief, Central Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group.
Well, he's something of a chameleon because he's known as one of the hardline rebel leaders from the Civil War, and he came into the political game rather late and was a rebel for a long time. But in 2015, he chose not to go back to the bush, and he chose to take the institutional route, and he took a position in Parliament, and he since pulled his party with him, and his party has remained a political party and has not gone back to the armed movement. So it depends which bit of him you look at, but it's not all that surprising that he's gone for the constitutional route, partly, I think, because he's chosen to go for the constitutional politics for a long time. And the other possibility, we don't have full confirmation of this, but the other possibility, of course, is that he's talking to the ruling party about what kind of arrangements we might see when the dust settles from this.
So let me ask you, how are his supporters taking the outcome of the election? Because I know they rejected the outcome. Some are saying that the Catholic Bishops' Conference is saying basically that there were instances of rigging and ballot stuffing, among other voter irregularities. So how are they reacting to this?
Well, I think we can go back to before election, when members of Agathon Rwasa's CNL party were severely harassed and intimidated by people connected to the ruling party, many of them arrested, beaten, and some of them disappeared or murdered. So I think there was already the ingredients there for a lot of anger. The CNL say they have a lot of evidence of ballot stuffing and vote rigging on the day. But of course, this wasn't an even playing field even going into the vote. And as you say, the Catholic Church has supported this. The National Elections Commission published what it called preliminary results and then has now withdrawn them. And this may be because some of those preliminary results weren't credible at all. And it now says it's going to publish further results later on.
Richard, some people have said the action of the CNE, the electoral body, is disastrous, a disastrous PR, and that undermines the credibility of the election results. What is your take on that?
Yes, so what happened is that the electoral body put some preliminary results up on their website, and they also presented them to diplomats in Bujumbura, and they've since then completely repudiated those results, pulled them off their website, and said they'll put other results further up. I think it's further evidence that these elections are not being run in a free and fair and proper manner. I think there was plenty of evidence of that beforehand. As I said, the situation going into the polls was far from satisfactory. But I think this is further evidence and will further anger opposition supporters. And I think will further damage the legitimacy of any government coming out of this.
Do you anticipate a possible unity government comprising people from the ruling party as well as Agathon Rwasa's party just to ease political tensions in Burundi?
This is one possible way forward. The other way forward is to give the opposition some sort of status, some sort of enhanced status within the National Assembly and within other institutions. The Arusha Accord of 2000, which is the basis on which Burundi came out of the civil war and is the basis for the writing of the constitution, does allow for various forms of power sharing. Now, those power sharing mechanisms are ethnic, they're concerning Hutu and Tutsi, but they can also be oriented towards different kinds of power sharing between political parties.
So let me ask you this, Richard. People have expressed concern about the way Burundi has been handling the cases of the coronavirus and that strong measures have yet to be implemented to limit the spread of the disease. They've even questioned why CNDD-FDD supporters are being grouped in places while they celebrate the electoral victory. Now we understand the First Lady has been taken to Nairobi to be treated for positive COVID-19 test. How is the current situation on the ground, as you've heard?
Well, we understand that the authorities have absolutely not taken this pandemic seriously. I think this is partly because they wanted to continue with the election process, which they felt that they had under good control from their point of view. And I think the second reason is that Burundi is not very internationally linked. It doesn't have a major airport, and there isn't much international travel. And I think it's likely that infections are relatively low. They are likely much higher than tested and reported cases, but that's true in many African countries. So at the moment, it seems that politically we have no leadership on the COVID issue in Burundi.
Richard Moncrieff is the Central Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Uganda has handed over to the DRC the bodies of two suspected militiamen who were shot dead on Lake Albert during an April gunfight with Ugandan troops. The bodies were exhumed from a cemetery where they were temporarily buried. Another five DRC nationals were handed amid renewed calls for immediate demarcation of Lake Albert boundaries. For VOA, Catherine Nambi reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
The two Congolese nationals, Opiyo Ozele and Singa Kowe, were killed as they allegedly tried to rob Ugandan fishermen of their gear, including boats, fishing nets, engines and hooks. Their bodies were temporarily buried in a cemetery in Uganda's Hoima district following a ban on cross-border movement to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Several others who were arrested during the operation have been in Ugandan detention centres. Talks between the two countries resulted in the repatriations. Brigadier Mike Onyara is the commander of the UPDF Marines who handed over the bodies.
The Congolese who entered Uganda illegally were apprehended by our Marine troops. Unfortunately, two died, but we have kept them humanely, as you saw for yourself, and we have repatriated five of them. We are also repatriating the dead bodies in two coffins which you have just seen, and we are also handing them back their boat and its motor engine.
Brigadier Nyara has called for joint Uganda DRC security vigilance on the lake.
We have developed joint patrols, standard operating procedures, which we have not utilized apparently, as you see, but working with our counterpart, the Congolese, we should stamp out all these illegalities on our lakes. Why? Because we have a harmonized joint plan.
Lieutenant Solomon Odosi received the bodies on behalf of the DRC government. He says more dialogue and demarcation of lake boundaries are needed to resolve conflicts on the shared lake.
We as brothers, we should avoid bloodshed. First thing we must do is to solve our problem in a peaceful way. This issue has been there for some time, which needs the region to get up and see the proper demarcations on this, on our resources here. I'm sure we reduce all what is happening at the moment.
Scores of Ugandan fishermen have died on Lake Albert, and fishing gear worth billions of shillings have been lost as attacks by suspected Congolese militiamen have increased in the past 2 years. The militias usually ask for a ransom of $500 to $800 to release the fishermen and their property, and sometimes sell it back cheaply to the fishermen. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection. Zuko so de Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the gentle strides of a tiger does not indicate cowardice. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.